It's another big give day through the Willamette Week Give Guide. If you haven't had a chance to give to KBOO, today is the day to do it.
Donate at kboo.fm/give today for a chance to win a Sony RX100 VA mirrorless camera from Pro Photo Supply.
If you're 35 or under, you have an even better chance to win. A second camera will be raffled off to one donor under the age of 36.
Your investment today matters. KBOO needs your support to broadcast and archive the voices, conversation, and artistry of our community.
Go to kboo.fm/give to contribute now.
Support KBOO.
Where music makes the movement.
Sometimes he would go away too. Then one night as I closed my eyes.
Good morning. Welcome to Black Book Talk, December edition. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, here with
Patricia Welch
and O.V. Hill, Mirror Image Books.
We are so lucky to have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Coco Laban, and she is the author of The Legend of the Chocolate River. Welcome.
Hello, how are you?
We are fine, and you?
Good.
So glad to have you with us today. I have to admit that I had a hard time this morning wanting chocolate.
Oh, no. I understand.
It's Christmas time, and the whole idea of a chocolate river had me going. I wanted to mix cocoa in with my coffee this morning, and I was saying, no, you can't do that.
Oh, yeah. I understand. I love chocolate.
Yes, and especially this time of the year.
Oh, yeah.
So I love the idea of a chocolate river and a chocolate book. So I'm imagining that small children are going to love it even more than me.
I think they will love it. Every now and then I hear of a child that does not like chocolate, but it's very rare.
I looked at the illustrations in the book, and they looked so lush and tropical, and I thought, oh, yeah, this is a good book for Christmas presents this year.
Right. I agree. It's really a fantasy adventure kind of book. And I had a lot of fun writing it. I wrote it many years ago. But I always, you know, can relate to the story. And it's a story that never gets old.
Could you tell us a little bit of the plot? Tell us a little bit of the story, leaving the exciting parts for people to read for themselves.
Of course. Basically, it's the story about two best friends, and it is a book about animals. I love writing about animals. So the main character in the book is Manda, who is a baby elephant, and his best friend is an old wise frog named Mr. Crowley. And they have this friendship. They live in the jungle together, and they go on walks through the jungle and just fantasize about different things, and they talk all day. And basically, Mr. Crowley had told Manda about this legendary chocolate river that he heard about when he was young. And Manda was really intrigued by this story. And he was like, well, we should go find this chocolate river. And Mr. Crowley is trying to let him know, well, I'm not really sure if it exists. It's just been this, you know, legend that people have talked about for years and years. And Manda, because he loves chocolate so much, he gets so excited about the idea of it that one day he just says, we should go find it. Well, because Mr. Crowley is a frog, he rides on Manda's back and that's kind of how they get around everywhere. And one day, Amanda just decides, I want to go find this chocolate river, so he just takes off running, and Mr. Crowley is trying to say, you know, maybe we shouldn't do this. It might be a dangerous journey. We may want to think about this a little bit. But Amanda's so excited about chocolate, so all Mr. Crowley can do is just hold on and go for the ride. Because really, Mr. Crowley would love to know if there's a real chocolate river himself, because he also likes chocolate. But he was never brave enough to make that journey. So off they go on this journey through the woods, and they followed these different paths. And Mr. Crowley remembers the story from his ancestors, and so he's able to tell Amanda, you know, where to go right in the jungle, where to go left, where to go up a hill or down a hill or around a corner. So he's able to kind of give him the directions based on what he remembered. And but the one really kind of dangerous part, they're going along okay, is they come over, and it's called Skeleton River. And the reason it's called Skeleton River is because these giant alligators live in this river, and it's probably the scariest part of the book, because they don't let anybody cross over that river. It's very dangerous. So, and the river is, yeah, okay, full of bombs, and they don't know anyone who successfully, you know, made this journey anyway.
Well, we don't want to tell them everything, so this is a cliffhanger.
Right.
So they're in a dangerous place, and we have hope.
Exactly.
But we all want to know. We want to have hope.
We have hope that they don't end up being another pile of bones.
Well, let's talk a little business. You said you wrote this book several years ago.
Right.
Okay, how do you go about now getting it republished and distributed? You wrote it when? What year?
I wrote this book in 2004. So I originally self-published the book with a company. It was under a different name at the time, but it's called, today it's known as Author House Publishing. And they help people, you know, publish their books. And it gets it to the market a little faster than a normal, you know, publisher that you would have to go and, like, pitch a story to. But you do take on a lot of the expenses of, you know, producing the book. And they take care of printing it and all that. There are a lot of expenses involved with it. So over the years, when I first put it out, maybe the first 2 or 3 years, I was very, very involved with doing a lot of, you know, book readings and doing a fair amount of appearances. And I, you know, did some local bookstores within, I would say, an hour or two of where I live in Alexandria, Virginia. And I would do book readings. I did some at my church, some at some private schools, some public schools, and some bookstores. I would say, I think the biggest group I had was probably, there was a bookstore in Occoquan, Virginia, and I must have had about 40 kids, I guess. So that was probably the biggest group. I would say between 40 and 50, maybe. Because my church ended up being a big group as well. But it became very sort of expensive to, you know, do a lot of the marketing myself, and I wasn't really getting the big return on investment that I was expecting. But the good thing about self-publishing is at least you get your book out, you know, they get it out to all of the different vendors all over the world. And it's, you know, it's on Amazon.com. It's on Barnes & Noble. I believe it's still on Walmart's site, Target. So it's really available all over the world. And, of course, on Author House Publishing. But it's a big undertaking.
So about the story, is it from a legend that you heard as a child or from your imagination?
I wish. If I knew that, I would probably be there trying to get some of the chocolate river myself. Basically, it came from, I started writing probably when I was about 8 years old. I used to write little stories on pieces of paper, and then I would fold it and staple them together, and I would do the illustrations and just the whole thing. So I've been writing all my life, you know. I still have a lot of my old original stories, which is kind of funny to look back at them. So I always wanted to write. I always was writing, but I just finally decided to actually try to publish something. But basically, I was watching, I believe it was on the Discovery Channel. They had this program about, it was based in Africa, and they were showing the wildebeest in Africa and how, I believe it's once a year, they migrate to a different part of the country, I think for food or water. I can't remember exactly what it was, but they migrate. Well, they have to cross this river that's full of these giant, and there is actually crocodiles. And I became so fascinated watching this, and I remember hundreds and hundreds of wildebeest trying to cross, and these crocodiles would come leaping out of the water, and they were just huge. And I didn't even know they got that big. I think they get up to like 20 feet or more. Mm-hmm. And they were just massive. And by the time I'm not going to get real descriptive with it because it could be a little gory, but just watching them grab these wildebeest, it was like watching a Great Dane pick up a kitten in its mouth. You know, it was just massive. So I was just really fascinated with that. And I think the more I looked at that, and I have always loved animals of all kinds. So the story kind of started with that. So it really almost started with that whole idea of some animal trying to cross Skeleton River. And I think with elephants, they're just so fascinating because they're so intelligent. And they just seem like really, they have a lot of human qualities. And that's one thing that I noticed also when I watched programs on Discovery or National Geographic or some other show with elephants, is how they really operate as a family, as a very strong family unit. And you always see the mothers, you know, protecting the baby elephants. And many times the entire herd will gather around to protect the baby elephant if there's a, you know, a lion near, or some other kind of animal trying to attack them, they would surround them. And I noticed that, you know, lions and tigers and all of that, like, they won't come attack the full-grown elephants generally. So that also became a part of the story that comes into play later on at the end of the story. So I can't tell you the ending.
No.
It has a lot to do with the ending, but it has a lot to do with how protective they are of each other, like in real life. So there's a lot of kind of realism mixed in with the fantasy part of the story. And then the whole, I mean, I just have that kind of imagination that I feel like it knows no bounds. Like, I could probably make up a book every other day, honestly.
Well, I'm curious about something now.
Yeah.
Clearly, and I think it's good for people to hear this, that you're not necessarily going to get rich by writing and selling a book. You know, there has to be some love in it, you know, especially if you're self-publishing.
Right.
So what do you do when you're not writing and publishing your own books? I'm listening to you talk about your love of animals, and I'm wondering if that's a part of your life outside of writing about it.
I will always love animals. I still love animals. I do not work at the zoo or anything that exciting. I actually work in strategic communications for the government.
Okay.
So that's my full-time job that actually pays the bills.
Okay.
And
allows you to publish your book. Okay.
Allows me to publish my book. but still I get to be creative. You know, I still get to be creative with communications and marketing and coming up with ideas for how to, you know, market something or promote something. So I still get to use that creativity, which is kind of the core of what I need to do.
Well,
you know,
could you tell us a little bit more about your job? Unfortunately, I think sometimes when people hear government job, the words creativity do not necessarily immediately come to mind. So if you could just tell us a little bit more about what you do.
So I am currently working on a contract for the National Science Foundation, which is kind of new. I just started in October. And right now, I am, you know, when you work for the government, you can't be too detailed.
This is true. We want you to keep your job. Just say what you can.
I actually used to work in much more sensitive positions. But basically, it's just helping with any initiative that they have. I have in the past software initiatives. I used to actually work in the IT environment pretty heavily. And if there was a new software that was coming out, I would create a communications plan to help people get accustomed to using the new software, or let them know that the software was coming or there was going to be a change. So there's a lot of strategy involved and a lot of writing. And I would also write a lot of articles for, you know, the internal government newspapers, you know, whatever the agency used internally. So there's always a lot of writing involved. So I do a lot of writing in general, and I'm also doing a lot of technical writing right now. So that's just a lot of writing and editing. Editing, and that sort of thing is not as exciting. So editing, you know, reports or briefings or things like that.
But okay, so you are able, in any way, you're keeping up your writing skills, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or whatever. That flow is still there.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Correct.
Now, are you an independent contractor?
I'm not an independent contractor. I work for a company.
And they assign you to various governmental agencies? Is that how it works?
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
They will win a contract with a agency, and then I was hired to work on a specific contract. But if that contract changes or ends for some reason, many times they'll put you on a different contract if they have other contracts for you.
Okay, so you'll go in and help with the editing process for these agencies too. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. I do a lot of editing. Yeah, editing, writing articles, you know, communications campaigns, all of that.
Let's get back to the book. How did the one get on top of the other? One is very small. Did he lift him with his trunk or?
How did that frog get up there?
Well, you know, I don't think I have
mind,
a
OB. You
I don't
have
think
a 5-year-old
I,
mind.
That's a very good question. I don't know that I have a specific description of how he got there. I imagine Nanda would pick him up with his trunk and, you know, put him on his back.
Yeah, that's what I imagined too.
Yeah,
I tried to think of him making the leap all the way up his back, and I thought, nah.
No, there's always going to be some kind of logic to it.
Yeah.
But if you watch them, they do that sort of, you know, they're very good at lifting things and doing that sort of thing. So they're very skilled with their trunk.
What age group would you recommend as the audience?
I actually recommend about 5 to 8. I think 4 is a little young for the book. You could read it probably to a 4-year-old and they would understand, but there's a lot of large paragraphs in the book, and when I originally wrote it, I really wasn't thinking in terms of any particular age group. You know, I just wanted to, you know, I had this idea and I wanted to write it out. But as I've read to kids in different classes and going to different schools and, you know, my own family, nieces and nephews, I think age 4, you wouldn't want to give them the book unless they're really advanced. So I think 5 to 8 is about right.
I'm curious. Excuse me, sorry. Working on allergies. Mm-hmm. You know, something, my question came and my question left.
Can I ask a question?
Go on, right.
So I heard through the grapevine that there's another book in the works.
That was my question.
Uh-oh. There you go.
Great minds.
There's another book that is actually completed. The writing part of it is completed, and I've already copyrighted it. And I just have to get it illustrated and published, basically, which I'm working on. But it's called Polo's Mail Truck Adventure.
Okay, you have to tell us a little bit more about that.
You might want to know about, okay. So basically, Polo is a kitten, which I love kittens. And basically, he ends up chasing a butterfly onto a mail truck, and then the mail truck, and he's so focused on the butterfly and all of that, he doesn't even realize that he's gotten up on this truck. And then the truck takes off with him on it. And so that becomes the adventure, because now, of course, this mail truck is out delivering packages and the kitten's on the truck. And the whole question is, you know, how is he going to get back home? You know, he doesn't know where he is. But in my books, I'm kind of making it a thing where the animals always talk. You know, they're not obviously just an animal with no feelings or emotion or any of that. They have full emotions. They think, they're intelligent, they talk to each other. They may talk, you know, they don't really talk to humans, but they talk to each other. And so that's just been something that's evolved with me, because I always feel like I can look at an animal and I kind of know what they're thinking. So I think it'll be a cute book once I get it illustrated, once I find the right.
Are there other animals in the book besides the butterfly and the kitten?
There's another cat in the book. There's another kitten in the book. And it's just the two kittens, I believe. It's just the two kittens in the book. There's a dog that's around, but I don't think the dog, you ever see the dog. And I would have to give away a little about the book to explain that one.
Question.
But, mm-hmm.
What's the process for getting an illustrator? Because that's so important, especially in children's literature.
You know, there's so many ways to do it, and these days, you know, you can hire people online all over the place. They have all these different websites. I think one is called, which I haven't tried yet, one is called Fiverr, that you can hire people for really small artwork, graphics, all kinds of things. I haven't tried that one yet. I did try to use one called, I think it's called Freelancer, and that one just didn't work out for me personally. One of the things with Freelancer, if you're trying to stay within a certain price range, and I was trying to keep my costs down, is that they have people available all over the world. So you can potentially hire someone in another country, keeping the cost down, but then you run into one issue, you run into is a lot of language barriers. Mm. and you communicate with the person, at least on this site, and I think most of them probably the same. They have sort of an online messaging system where you can send descriptions, you can upload documents, that sort of thing. So if you don't know a personal illustrator, you don't have, you know, someone can refer to you. You know, there's all kind of ways. You know, I could probably go to an art school and get a student or something. But my brother actually illustrated my first book, and I paid him for illustrating my first book.
He did a great job.
Thank you. He did. He actually has a degree in commercial art. But I wanted him to do this book as well, but he was having some problems with his eyes. He had some eye surgery, and he just didn't feel like it was kind of a strain on his eyes to do it. Mm-hmm. So he kind of passed on trying to do it this time. So it's not as comfortable working with someone you don't know, because, you know, with copyright issues and, you know, needing to be able to use the graphics, you know, when I'm doing marketing and promotion on Facebook or on another site, it gets a little tricky, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking that you're doing all this without actually, you could conceivably do all this without ever having a face-to-face conversation, you know, in person.
Absolutely.
Which is great. I mean, that's the wonderful freedom that technology gives you, but still...
I'm still kind of navigating that whole thing, and then you have to think about, wow, do I need to get an attorney? And because I need full use of the illustrations, you know, because I've done, you know, printed bookmarks before, and I knew my brother was like, do what you want to do, I don't care, you know. You know, there was no issues there. But with someone else that I don't know, sometimes people are funny about, well, no, I want to, you know, copyright this image, and you can only use it here, here, and here, or I want to get paid every time you use it. You know, it gets really complicated, and I've only done the one book at this point where I didn't even deal with a lot of that, so it's still kind of tricky, and so I'm trying to do a lot of research in between, which is why it's taken me a while to figure out how I want to get this book out, or if I just want to go to a traditional publisher.
Let me break in here for just a moment, because we only have a couple of minutes left. Mm-hmm. It seems to be in the self-publishing industry, and with all this new technology going on, a lot of hitchhiking, mm-hmm. and that seems mm-hmm. to be the theme in your book. Somebody jumping on someone else's back and giving a ride to wherever they want to go.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I've actually found it very difficult to track the money that my book is actually making or not making, because it is distributed so many places, and I have, you know, they typically will send you a check of some kind every quarter. And the checks have not been more than what I've actually, the money I put into the book. Very tricky.
Yeah.
Very tricky. Yeah.
But you will let us know when the next book is published.
Absolutely.
It has been such a pleasure having you as our guest today.
I appreciate you guys asking me to come by. I really had a great time talking with you.
Yes, well, we abundant book sales for you.
And happy holidays to you and all of your little characters.
Happy holidays to you all.
Okay.
And don't forget, I have a Facebook page for Coco LeBun.
Yes, I went to the Facebook page to look. It's a very nice one, too.
Okay, this is the December issue of Black edition of Black Book Talk closing down. Happy holidays to all of you who are listening to us, whichever holidays you're celebrating.
See you next month.
Bye-bye.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. only on KBOO Portland.